The appeal of the slogan was immediately evident. Even advertisers along the president's route appropriated his phrase, headlining a square deal in their copy. A real estate company in Butte, Montana, began its pitch with Roosevelt's words, "We must treat each man on his worth and merits as a man. We must see that each is given a square deal, because he is entitled to no more and should receive no less." Reaching Yellowstone, Roosevelt bid a temporary farewell to the newspaper men, who were instructed to stay behind. Accompanied by John Burroughs, he intended to relax for 2 weeks, to watch birds and simply observe rather than hunt the big game, the herds of elk, antelope, and black-tailed deer. Roosevelt had stayed with the older man in his log cabin 3 years earlier, striking Burroughs as a great boy filled with inexhaustible energy. He climbed everything on the place, the naturalist recalled, with mixed awe and dread. He shinned up tree after tree, running his arms into every high holes and woodpecker's nest, while I stood on the ground below, shuddering and waiting for him to fall. Their stay at Yellowstone convinced Burroughs that the presidency had altered Roosevelt little. He remained a man of such abounding energy and ceaseless activity that he sets everything in motion around him wherever he goes, observed Burroughs. Nothing escaped him, from bears to mice, from wild geese to chickadees, from elk to red squirrels. He took it all in, and he took it in as only an alert, vigorous mind can take it in. These invigorating days in Yellowstone and a subsequent camping trip in the magnificent forests of Yosemite with Sierra Club founder John Muir deeply impressed Roosevelt and informed the tone of his speeches during the remainder of the trip. Turning from trusts and the tariff, he increasingly focused on the importance of preserving the country's national heritage from exploitation. He arrived at the Grand Canyon as a great contest raged over whether to preserve the landmark as a national monument or open it up to mining for precious metals. "Leave it as it is," he urged his countrymen. "The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it. Keep it for your children, your children's children, and for all who come after you as one of the great sights which every American should see." Deeply moved by this great wonder of nature, Roosevelt resolved to ensure the designation of the Grand Canyon as a national park. If Roosevelt had done nothing else as president, Douglas Brinkley has observed, his advocacy on behalf of preserving the canyon might well have put him in the top ranks of American presidents. When the presidential party reached the California coast, Roosevelt took a special detour on a narrow-gauge road into the San Lorenzo Valley, home to a majestic grove of giant sequoias. "I am, oh, so glad to be here," he exclaimed. "This is the first glimpse I have ever had of the big trees." At Stanford University the next day, he exhorted his audience to protect these mighty trees, these wonderful monuments of beauty. It seemed a desecration to turn a tree which was old when the first Egyptian conqueror penetrated to the valley of the Euphrates into house siding or decks or porches. While many would hold that practical progress should trump aesthetic value, Roosevelt argued, "There is nothing more practical in the end than the preservation of beauty, than the preservation of anything that appeals to the higher emotions in mankind." The vital role of these massive redwoods, the great monarchs of the woods, was confined neither to their commercial value nor to their natural beauty. The primary object of his overall forest policy, Roosevelt insisted, was not to preserve forests because they are beautiful, though that is a good in itself, not to preserve them because they are refuges for the wild creatures of the wilderness, though that too is good in itself, but rather to conserve them in order to guarantee a steady and continuous supply of timber, grass, and above all, water that would foster the growth of prosperous communities. Contrary to the prevailing view, Roosevelt foresaw that our natural resources were not inexhaustible. Destructive lumbering practices had already seriously depleted forests. In clear language, he delineated the causal connection between forest protection and water conservation. Forests absorb water and slow the melting of snow in the spring. They prevent the rain from rushing away in uncontrollable torrents. They regulate the flow of streams. In every watershed, forests help determine the amount of available water that can transform a wasteland into a veritable Garden of Eden. In speech after speech, Roosevelt lauded the passage of the 1902 Reclamation Act, which, for the first time, made substantial federal funds available to construct dams, reservoirs, and other irrigation projects in the West. Intended to open small irrigated farms to actual settlers, to actual homemakers, the legislation stipulated that tracts of land larger than 160 acres would be ineligible for federally sponsored irrigation. In this way, the government sought to ensure that speculators would not commandeer the program's benefits. We do not ever want to let our land policy be shaped so as to create a big class of proprietors who rent to others, Roosevelt asserted. America's forests and waters must come into the hands not of a few men of great wealth or into the hands of a few men who speculated them, but be distributed among many men, each of whom intends to make him a home on the land. Of the five irrigation projects underway in the spring of 1903, in Colorado, Montana, Wyoming, Nevada, and Arizona, the most prominent was a huge masonry arch dam in Arizona's Salt River Valley. When Charles Walcott, director of the U.S. Geological Survey, announced on April 18th that the government had selected the Salt River Valley for its first big enterprise, a banner headline in the Arizona Republic hailed the decision. The day of deliverance is at hand. The reservoir created by the project, later christened the Roosevelt Dam, would be, excepting the work being done on the Nile, the greatest in the world. Designed to irrigate 200,000 acres, the dam promised to make the community near Phoenix, with a population then of 25,000, one of the most prosperous in the country. The estimated cost of the five projects would total $7 million. Which settlers would then repay to the government over a 10-year period. Once completed, Roosevelt predicted, these irrigation projects would more profoundly impact the entire western region over the next half century than any other material movement whatsoever. He could already envision a new type of settler throughout the West, who could build homes, roads, businesses, schools, and places of amusement, populating bustling towns and cities that might one day contain 1 million inhabitants. Moreover, an arable, enticing West could alleviate some of the social evils caused by overcrowding in the East. Century magazine suggested that Roosevelt's decision to highlight issues of conservation, irrigation, and preservation would have an educational effect upon the people, fostering a new determination to protect the Western wonderlands, expand national parks, and institute a sustainable scientific approach to managing the nation's wilderness areas. Any action to safeguard forest lands was usually delayed until the end of a president's term, the author noted, but Roosevelt would not hesitate to throw the full force of his influence behind legislation that would halt the ruinous waste of the great national forests. From California, the president's train headed north to Portland, Oregon, and Seattle, Washington, before veering east for the long trip home. Roosevelt had delivered 265 speeches, once addressing 9 crowds in a single day. He had participated in countless parades, endured long banquets, and gained 11 pounds, met with all manner of local officials, dedicated monuments, and attended military reviews. Sustained by the enthusiastic reception all along his travel route, he returned, according to Edith, as fresh and unworn as when he left. Roosevelt had scarcely settled into the White House, however, when reports surfaced of possible governmental corruption at the Salt River Project. Objections and accusations swirled around the choice of Salt River for the government's inaugural project. During congressional debates over the Reclamation Act, talk of making desert lands in the public domain blossom like a rose abounded. Ultimately, the government hoped to open these revitalized lands to individual settlers at a small cost under the Homestead Act. Yet, given that almost all the land in the Salt River Valley was already in private hands, such settlements represented a glaring problem. For 20 years, private funds had irrigated the valley. Unlike the four smaller projects, this reservoir would irrigate no public lands, but only those in private ownership, vastly increasing, of course, their value. Indeed, irrigated lands would likely quadruple in value when the government completed its work. To further complicate matters, some of the tracts, undoubtedly held by speculators, covered upwards of 10,000 acres, many times the established limit of 160 acres. Opportunities for corruption seemed boundless. As Roosevelt struggled to address the complex situation in Arizona, he turned to Ray Baker for insight and counsel. Ever since Baker's early biographical sketch had caught his attention, Roosevelt had followed the reporter's career, occasionally sending him short notes commending his excellent work. He had read Baker's now famous January article on the brutality between union men and the scabs, who had continued to work during the coal strike, and gauged the public reaction to Baker's gripping investigative piece. Despite his firm support of trade unions, Roosevelt strongly believed that members who engaged in violent acts, such as Baker described, should be held accountable. "We intend to do absolute justice to every man," he repeatedly proclaimed, "whether he be capitalist or wage worker, union man or non-union man." While Baker shared this conviction, he had initially hesitated when McClure suggested he study the violence perpetrated against non-striking miners. He was loath to provide ammunition for mere stupid opposition to all labor organizations, or to compromise the labor leaders he had come to know and respect over the years. Furthermore, the coal strike had erupted during his second leave of absence from the magazine, as he began long-postponed work on his novel exploring the nation's grave social and economic plight. He had finally moved from New York to East Lansing, a quiet hamlet near the campus of Michigan State College, where his father-in-law still taught biology. Baker calculated that his savings would last at least a year. The change delighted his wife tremendously, drawing their three children close to their grandparents and reuniting her with childhood friends. Baker would never forget the feeling of joyful independence as he settled into his new home and commenced work on his novel. On his study wall, he hung portraits of Walt Whitman, Leo Tolstoy, and his own father. He tacked favorite quotations to the back of the desk, which, he noted with satisfaction, was "the first desk I ever had that was big enough, where I could spread out my elbows and work as long as I wanted to, without interruption." "I actually thought my future was settled," Baker recalled of the brief respite. "I did not count sufficiently upon S.S. McClure." Eager to keep his gifted young reporter, McClure had contacted him in October of 1902 as the coal strike was escalating. The magazine, he generously proposed, would pay a weekly stipend throughout the year, while Baker would have to work only 6 months. The rest of the year, he would be free to pursue his own writing, which McClure's would publish on liberal terms. "So the serpent in my new Eden," Baker ruefully jested. "The proposition too tempting to reject." Baker had just arrived at the magazine's New York office when he received word that McClure wanted him in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, where the coal strike was just ending. McClure himself had traveled to the coal region shortly after his summer vacation in Europe, joining dozens of reporters, writers, and publishers gathered to cover the historic strike. Recognizing that the press was saturated with stories about the terrible coalfield conditions that had precipitated the 5-month strike, McClure sought a different aspect of the story. Despite the abysmal conditions, some miners had kept on the job, refusing to support fellow strikers, even at the risk of violent reprisal. "What sort of men were they?" McClure pondered. The story of the scabs was yet untold, and McClure felt that no one was better suited to investigate the matter than Ray Baker. When they met at the Hotel Sterling at the corner of River and Market Streets, the buoyant McClure presented his idea to Baker. The young writer was less sanguine, explaining his concern that so long as public opinion was generally hostile to labor unionism, it must be emphasized that the strikebreakers' plight was only one aspect of a highly complex problem. But the longer he considered the proposal, the more curious he grew about the 17,000 of roughly 140,000 miners who persisted in working. Baker had always been intrigued by the motivation of the few who went against the many, and in the end, to McClure's delight, he agreed to stay in the coal region for a month or more to talk with these men and learn why they refused to support the union. With the same exacting impartiality that marked his investigation of the Pullman strike, Baker sought out people on all sides of the scab issue. He talked with the miners in the kitchens of their homes and descended with them down the shafts into the mines, taking note of the low wages, company houses, company stores, poor schools, wretched living conditions in the collieries. He sat in on union meetings where the scabs were bitterly denounced and interviewed John Mitchell, whom he found singularly steady-headed in the wake of the turbulent strike. In hotel suites, thick with cigar smoke, he discussed the conflict with fellow writers and radical leaders, including Henry D. Lloyd and Clarence Darrow. Armed with a range of opinions, he spent weeks with scores of non-striking miners, talking with them and their families, eliciting their perspectives of the realities that led to their decision to continue working, even under such treacherous conditions. "What men I met during those fiery weeks," he recalled. "What stories they told me. What dramas of human suffering, human loyalty, and human fear." McClure was thrilled with Baker's letters from the field. "Don't, my dear boy, be afraid of space," he urged. "We can give this thing all the space it requires, all the articles it requires. I am glad you have struck such a rich mine." A week later, McClure wrote again. The New York Sun had devoted two columns that day to a sermon delivered in Brooklyn on the subject of the feuds in the coal fields, the bitterness between union and non-union men, the uncompromising hatred opening wounds that only death can heal. Baker's subject had become the most important question of the day, McClure reassured Baker. "I'm going down to go over the material with you myself," he added. "You have done magnificently." Baker completed his piece, which McClure titled "The Right to Work," just in time for inclusion in the landmark issue. At Baker's insistence, the editor's note preceded the piece to clarify the magazine's support for labor unions. While the magazine would continue to advocate for the nation's working men, the editor explained, "the public is beginning to distinguish between unionism and the sins of unionists, as it is between organized capital and the sins of capitalists." By illuminating individual lives of the strikebreakers, Baker also stressed in his opening, he neither intended to challenge the rights of labor to organize nor question the sincerity of the labor leader. Instead, he simply wanted to offer a detailed series of case histories, exploring why these men continued to work in spite of so much abuse and even real danger. The story of John Colson dramatically illustrated the divisive impact of the strike within mining families. An engineer from the small town of Gilberton, Pennsylvania, Colson enjoyed the best position at the colliery. Although not a member of the union, he initially went out with the strikers. With no prospect of a settlement after several months, however, he took a job at a distant colliery while his wife remained at home with the children. The moment spies determined that Colson had gone back to work, his wife was targeted for retaliation. Stores would not serve her. Former friends repudiated her in the streets. Neighbors pelted her with rocks. When she tried to move, no teamster would help her. A mob finally tracked down Colson himself, beating him so badly that he was mistakenly listed among those murdered during the strike. After talking with Colson and his wife, Baker went to visit Colson's elderly parents 4 miles away. Mrs. Colson spoke with pride of her sons, all miners, all union members who had faithfully maintained the strike. She discussed her eldest son, John, reluctantly. "He might better be dead," she declared, "for he's brought disgrace on the name. He deserved all he got. He wasn't raised a scab." Never again would the family acknowledge him. The strike, Baker wrote, had wholly crushed all family feeling. Likewise, Baker's reporting illustrated how all too often lifelong friendships, like familial bonds, became casualties of the conflict. A strong believer in unions, Hugh Johnson nonetheless considered this strike, the second in 2 years, a bad idea. Although he voted against it, he remained out with the strikers until he could no longer afford to pay his family's living expenses. As soon as he returned to work, troubles began. His daughter was fired from her job as a teacher, his son harassed at school, and his wife prevented from buying food and supplies at the local stores. One night, a mob chased and threatened to kill him. All these things, Baker observed, were done by his neighbors and friends, among whom he had lived an honorable life for years. As the strike dragged on, the level of violence escalated. One telling example involved James Winstone, a respected community leader. Winstone, too, had argued against the strike, but stayed out to support his fellow workers. Informed that he did not qualify for assistance from the Union Relief Fund because he owned property, Winstone finally returned to work. In late September, only a few days before the strike was settled, he was clubbed to death by 3 longtime neighbors. Such stories, Baker insisted, constituted only a few among scores, even hundreds, of similar tragedies of the Great Coal Strike. Baker returned to East Lansing after completing the article, on fire with the wealth of new material, new characters, and above all, new understandings of the human elements involved in the labor struggle. He happily anticipated sitting at his desk to work on his novel gloriously all winter long. As January turned to February, however, he found it increasingly difficult to concentrate. Clippings arrived from all over the country praising his article. "Everything has borne out the truthfulness and value of the article you wrote," McClure congratulated him. His case histories had dramatized a vital aspect of the conflict, the price paid by non-striking miners, better than anything else written. McClure sought to entice him with the prospect of an entire series on labor. Baker found himself making scant headway on his novel, unable to write fiction when the world seemed literally on fire with critical, possibly revolutionary movements in which he was deeply interested. Putting the fiction aside, he returned to New York, where a powerful new interest, a common purpose, was energizing McClure's office. The enthusiasm generated by the magazine's critical and popular success was palpable. "I doubt whether any other magazine published in America ever achieved such sudden and overwhelming recognition," Baker proudly remarked. "We had put our fingers upon the sorest spots in American life." The staff members at McClure's had always worked closely, even while pursuing diverse interests. Now that their respective investigations into the problems of modern industrial society substantially overlapped, they eagerly read one another's works, often suggesting further lines of inquiry. Tarbell's disclosures of J.D. Rockefeller's illegal activities resonated with Stephan's endeavor to trace political corruption to the captains of industry. Tarbell looked to Stephan's for an understanding of the invisible web that linked businessmen to politicians, politicians to judges. Indeed, the intensity of these reciprocally informing projects and the sense of camaraderie in a momentous cause affected Baker profoundly. "I have wondered," he later wrote, "if there could have been a more interesting editorial office than ours, one with more of the ozone of great ideas, touch-and-go experimentation, magic success." This rare formula, he noted, owed as much to rigorous and honest feedback as to affectionate support. "We were friends indeed, but we were also uncompromising critics of one another," Baker recalled. 40 years later, Baker still considered John Phillips the most creative editor he had worked with in his entire life. "He could tell wherein an article failed and why," he recalled. "He could usually make fertile suggestions for improving it. He was willing to give the writer all the precious time he needed for rewriting his story." The office itself, now situated just east of the Flatiron Building on 23rd Street, reflected the collaborative ardor of McClure's staff. The walls in the hallway were a mosaic of original artwork designed for the pages of the magazine. Mementos from individual articles decorated each writer's office. They even had special names for one another. McClure was the Chief, Stephens was Steph, and Ida M. Tarbell was affectionately dubbed I Dare 'em. In her office, she proudly displayed a framed note from the humorist Finley Peter Dunne. "I dare 'em. She is a lady, but she has the punch." No one, Baker said of Tarbell, lived so warmly in the hearts of her friends. Never had he known a finer human spirit, so generous, so modest, so full of kindness, so able, so gallant, and yet with such good sense and humor. The exhilarating atmosphere in the office persuaded Baker to accept the chief's suggestion and embark upon a series of labor articles. Why bother with fictional characters and plots, he told himself, when the world was full of more marvelous stories that were true, and characters so powerful, so fresh, so new, that they stepped into the narratives under their own power. The president's request for Baker's help uncovering possible corruption in Arizona reached the reporter in Chicago, where he was researching the first of five lengthy articles on various aspects of the labor problem. As the celebrated series unfolded, Roosevelt would frequently reach out to Baker for advice and counsel on labor issues. In the summer of 1903, however, as Roosevelt labored to assess the contentious Salt River situation, he recalled a more obscure series on the Southwest Baker had written for the literary Century magazine the previous year. Like Roosevelt, Baker recognized the transformative potential of irrigation. Using language close to Roosevelt's heart, Baker described riding through miles of desert with no sign of living creatures, only to discover a green stretch of well-watered acreage with rows of rustling cottonwoods, the roofs of home, and the sound of cattle in the meadows. A wire fence was the dividing line. On this side lay the fruitless desert. On the other, green alfalfa, full of blossoms and bees, brimming over the fences. The sight, Baker proclaimed, was something to stir a man's heart. "My dear Mr. Baker," Roosevelt wrote on June 25th, explaining his dilemma and soliciting Baker's guidance. "As you know, I am especially concerned over the irrigation project. At times I hear rumors of crookedness in connection with the government irrigation work, especially in Arizona. I have been utterly unable hitherto to get any definite statement in reference thereto. It has occurred to me that you may be able privately to tell me something about this." Baker swiftly responded, promising to share all the information gleaned concerning the Salt River project. He had, in fact, returned to Arizona earlier that spring, contemplating another irrigation article. Moreover, he had been present at the meetings when Director Walcott delivered his decision in favor of the Water Users Association in Salt River, and had spent time on an alfalfa ranch in order to get at the exact sentiment of the people. While he had witnessed no overt corruption, Baker had little doubt that something was wrong. Promoters of the Water Users Association, backed by the government officials, relied on overbearing methods that were suspicious in the extreme. He assured the president that he would gladly call at the White House when he returned to Washington the following week. "I suppose that the government officials you speak of must be in the Geological Survey," Roosevelt replied, adding that, "in public life, as in private life, a man of the very highest repute will occasionally go wrong." Still, he recognized that accusations and rumors are readily fabricated, and in such cases, it is most desirable that their falsity be shown. Some criticism of Director Walcott was undoubtedly political, fueled by Republicans upset with projects recommended in Democratic states, as well as senators and congressmen in the Rocky Mountain region furious over the choice of Arizona, still a territory without representation in Congress. Regardless of the origins, Roosevelt insisted that if he or any other government official has gone wrong in Arizona, I am more anxious than any other man can be to get at it. He requested that Baker do him the favor of stopping first to see Gifford Pinchot at the Forestry Division, and then joining him for lunch at Oyster Bay. "If there is any kind of ground for believing in fraud of any sort by government officials," he concluded, "I want to consult with you as to the best way of setting men to work so as to be sure of our getting the proof." Baker was thrilled by the prospect of working closely with the president, either to uncover corruption or to dispel malicious, career-destroying rumors. "I was so eager to help," he recalled, "that I got together a large package of notes and memoranda, also maps and pictures, and a veritable article of several thousand words on which I'd spent several days of hard work, setting forth in detail the exact situation in the Salt River Valley as I had seen it. He took another day to compile a memorandum on the coal fields, just in case Roosevelt ventured to discuss labor issues as well. I was determined to be fully prepared, he explained, to give the President of the United States several hours of sound enlightenment and instruction. Baker's study of the Arizona situation convinced him that the government's choice of Salt River was perfectly justified. If ever men worked miracles, he wrote, it was in Salt River. Sustained by private capital, neighbors had cooperated for decades to dig ditches and build canals in order to divert water. From inhospitable desert, they had wrested three cities replete with electric lights, fine hotels, schools, and churches, all shaded by mature trees and bordered by thriving and productive orchards of oranges, almonds, olives, and figs. After 7 years of insufficient rainfall and reckless deforestation, however, the implacable desert was closing in again. Homes were reluctantly abandoned as orchards died, fields withered, and land values plummeted. Without the infusion of vast government capital to build a great reservoir, this once thriving valley would perish. Baker carefully considered how two related factors complicated the situation. Vast tracts of land were already under private ownership, and unscrupulous developers might lure more people into the valley than the water project could supply. The morning of July 15th, Baker boarded a train at Long Island City. En route to Oyster Bay, where the president was spending the summer, he ran into an old Chicago acquaintance, H.H. Kohlsatt, publisher of the Record Herald. Treasury Secretary Leslie Mortimer Shaw and Charles J. Bonaparte, a noted attorney who was investigating postal fraud for the Justice Department, also joined them aboard the train. Upon arrival, the four men crowded into a horse-driven public carriage for the three-mile journey to Sagamore Hill. "The president lives very simply," Baker informed his father. "I thought as I drove over from the station what some modern German or English worthy might say on entering the president's grounds and seeing no guards or military anywhere about." A maid ushered the guests into the library to wait for the president. Robust, hearty, wholesome, like a gust of wind, he soon burst in, wearing knee-length breeches and an old coat. The company at lunch included members of the Roosevelt family and the president's old friend, Jacob Riis. "Theodore Roosevelt," Baker observed, "takes an extraordinary interest in life, gets pleasure out of everything. His mind seems to leap upon every question with boundless enthusiasm." Roosevelt first addressed the alleged postal corruption, assuring Bonaparte that he desired an exhaustive investigation. "I don't care whom it hurts," he assured Baker. "We must get to the bottom of these scandals." Shifting the conversation to Arizona, he reiterated that his irrigation development must benefit the individual settler rather than the wealthy landowner or speculator. Baker understood the difficulty of realizing this intention, but a recently promulgated regulation promised to guide the project in that direction. The government had announced that landowners possessing more than 160 acres must put extra acreage on the market at reasonable prices or receive no water from the reservoir. Unaware of these developments, Roosevelt suddenly turned to Baker. "Who is the chief devil down there in the Salt River Valley?" Baker was momentarily unsure how to respond to such a query. When he hesitated, the president burst into a vigorous, picturesque, and somewhat vitriolic description of the situation, implying that if he could catch the rascals who were causing the trouble, he would execute them on the spot. Baker was taken aback by Roosevelt's simplistic diatribe. "But when I tried to break into the conversation, boiling inside with my undelivered articles and memoranda, one of which I tried to draw from my pocket, the president put one fist on the table beside him, looked at me earnestly, and said, 'Baker, you and I will have to get together on these subjects.'" Startled by Roosevelt's pugnacity, Baker and the guests adjourned to the library following dinner. As the time drew near for leaving, Baker recollected, "I began to wonder when the president would ask me for the information upon which I had spent so much time and hard work. I had my heavy briefcase in hand when I went up to say goodbye, and my grand plans for enlightening the government of the United States vanished in a handshake." Despite the self-deprecatory tone of this account, Baker's meticulous research, later passed on to Gifford Pinchot, eventually proved invaluable. His conclusion that government agents were doing everything possible to carry out the president's purposes in a complex situation cleared Charles Walcott of suspicion. In a letter to Baker, Pinchot expressed great satisfaction that Baker had arrived at his vindicating assessment despite his initial suspicions. Several months later, Theodore Roosevelt received an advance copy of Baker's exposé on the corrupt relationship between Sam Parks, the powerful boss of New York's Builders Union, and the Fuller Company, the leading contractor in the city. The president quickly penned a long note to the reporter. "I am immensely impressed by your article. While I had known in a rather vague way that there was such a condition as you describe, I had not known its extent, and as far as I am aware, the facts have never before been brought before the public in such striking fashion." Lincoln Steffens had provided Baker with the basis for this first extended study of the role labor racketeering played in the rise of the trusts. Investigating municipal corruption in Chicago and New York, Steffens had unearthed evidence that large building contractors were colluding with corrupt labor bosses to force smaller contractors out of business to eliminate competition. When he shared this material with his colleague, Baker spent months pursuing his own investigation. This research culminated in the stunning charge that the Fuller Construction Company was providing a regular salary to the union leader. In The Trust's New Tool, The Labor Boss, Baker focused on one disturbing question. While the great building strike of 1903 paralyzed construction through all of Manhattan, why did one firm, the Fuller Construction Company, keep on building? In answer, Baker laid out evidence that for years, the Fuller Company had paid Sam Parks to look after its interests. Baker traced Parks' ascent from railroad brakeman to bridge builder, from walking delegate of the Housesmiths and Bridgemen's Union, to undisputed boss of the Board of Building Trades. The board, comprised of the walking delegates who represented workmen in each of 36 unions affiliated with the building industry, was designed to protect the interests of its members. In theory, Sam Parks was simply a paid agent for his union, receiving the same salary as an ordinary workman in his trade. In reality, Baker tracked him riding about in his cab, wearing diamonds, appearing on the street with his blooded bulldog, supporting his fast horses, treating his friends. How reminiscent, Baker grimly observed, of the familiar affluent aldermen or police captains of our cities building $50,000 residences on salaries of $1,500 or less. Indeed, the more he studied the situation, the more parallels emerged between Sam Parks and Tammany Chief Richard Croker. A half-decade earlier, the Fuller Construction Company had arrived in New York from Chicago. Starting with no business at all, they had swiftly risen to become the greatest construction company in the world, with the largest single building business in New York, and important branches in Chicago, Baltimore, and Philadelphia. Behind the Fuller Company, Baker found a familiar cast of characters. Charles Schwab represented the steel industry, Cornelius Vanderbilt the railroad industry, and James Stillman, president of Rockefeller's bank, the financial industry. A gigantic hand had reached into New York, Baker observed, echoing Tarbell's descriptions of Standard Oil's stranglehold grip on the oil region. The hand of the trust. Baker's article also detailed the events ultimately leading to Parks' arrest. Curiously enough, Baker remarked, the Fuller Company brought Sam Parks from Chicago when it came. The flamboyant labor boss proved helpful in a variety of ways. Offering no explanation to fellow union members, he unilaterally called strikes designed to cripple Fuller's independent competitors. Worse still, Baker observed, strikes were often accompanied by a demand for money before they could be settled. Rumors of blackmail, bribes, and pocketed spoils had circulated for years before District Attorney William Travers Jerome finally indicted Parks. In discovery, Jerome learned that Parks had approached the Hecla Ironworks, threatening to call a strike unless he was paid $1,000. When the company balked, The ensuing strike lasted for several weeks, costing the company $50,000 and keeping over 1,000 men out of work. Only when Hecla agreed to Park's extortion, paying double the amount originally demanded, did the walkout end. When the $2,000 check surfaced, endorsed by Parks and cashed by the Fuller Company, the district attorney finally had sufficient grounds to arrest the labor boss. Roosevelt told Baker that his exposé illustrated with graphic urgency the need of drawing the line on conduct among labor unions, among corporations, among politicians, and among private individuals alike. The president noted sardonically that the organs of Wall Street men of a certain type are bitter in their denunciations of the labor unions and have not a word to say against the iniquity of the corporations. The labor leaders of a certain type howl against the corporations, but do not admit that there is any wrong ever perpetrated by labor men. Baker's even-handed investigation and subsequent critique of both labor and capital dovetailed with Roosevelt's own approach. The president invited Baker to the White House to further discuss the matter. "When I get back east again," Baker replied, "I shall be more than pleased to accept your invitation." Roosevelt's commendation, he continued, made him feel more strongly than ever that there is here a great duty to perform, to bring out these conditions clearly and fairly and, above all, truthfully. Furthermore, he added, "Mr. McClure is giving me the best medium in this country to do so." McClure and Phillips were delighted with the widespread commentary engendered by Baker's labor pieces. The Wall Street Journal printed a fierce editorial condemning corporate corruption and demanding change. When the corporations have their paid agents in the trade unions, as they have their paid agents in the legislatures and in the executive councils of great parties, the necessity for reform in corporate management is clear. The only way the trusts and the labor unions can hope to stand long without harsh, restrictive legislation is to play square with the people. And when Harvard professor John Brooks publicly endorsed Baker's analysis, college students across the country flocked to hear the man considered the greatest reporter in the country. "You have gone into a splendid field of material, and you are getting the mastery of it," Phillips wrote to his rising star, claiming, "before you are through with this, you will know more than anyone else about labor questions in America." Steffens congratulated Baker on the greatest triumph a man can have with a pen, maintaining that the Parks piece had made both sides see themselves as they are. He confessed his own difficulty writing after reading Baker's article, finding himself oppressed by a yellow streak of jealousy that left him burning with shame. He finished with a question at once rueful and admiring. "Ever catch yourself at mean thinking? I guess not. I envy you your perfect honesty." Baker followed his success with The Lone Fighter, a biographical piece on the union leader Robert Neidig, who had worked for years to combat Parks's pernicious influence. Initially, his struggle seemed futile. Just as the political bosses kept their power because only a small minority of the public attended party primaries, despotic union leadership endured when but a small percentage of union members attended meetings. The majority, Baker explained, were tired at night and wanted to go home and play with their babies. Neidig, a steel builder with a wife and children, decided early on to take his union responsibilities in earnest. He never missed a meeting and gradually built up a following. At election time, however, Parks exercised the full power of his corrupt machine. "We hear of repeaters and purchased votes," Baker reported, "even of fraudulent ballots and fraudulent counts." Neidig was threatened with personal violence, with loss of his job, and even with expulsion from the union. Nothing, it seemed, could break the labor boss's hold on the union, not even his indictment. Nevertheless, Neidig refused to abandon his efforts to build an honest union, and Baker's detailed revelations about Parks helped turn the tide. "The lone fighter is not alone," one correspondent observed, "when there are other lone fighters to act at the same time with him." One union member confessed to Baker that before reading the article, he had considered Parks a true and faithful officer of our union and repeatedly supported him in elections. He considered Baker's piece by far the best exposition of the causes of the present labor troubles, and recommended that it be placed in the hands of working men everywhere. Robert Nydig gratefully assured Baker that his splendid exposé had done more to weaken Parks and Parksism than any article that had been published. Within the union itself, its impact had been tremendous. Members finally understood the wrong that had been done them, and were ready to take action. "To you belongs a large part of the credit," Nydig commended Baker, concluding that an excellent prospect now existed of overthrowing Parks and reorganizing the union on a sound and honest basis. "My present work interests me very deeply," Baker reported to his father. "It seems almost as if I had a mission to perform, to talk straight out on a difficult subject." With justifiable pride, he noted that between his own work and that of Tarbell and Steffens, his magazine was probably doing more now in stirring up the American people than any other publication ever did before. Chapter 13. Toppling Old Bosses. Roosevelt tried to prolong his 1903 summer vacation, recognizing that once he returned to the nation's capital, there would be mighty little let-up to the strain. "It was as lovely a summer as we have ever passed," he told Corinne. "The happiest, healthiest, most old-fashioned kind of a summer." Of all the Roosevelt children, only 19-year-old Alice was absent, choosing to spend most of July and August with her fashionable friends in Newport, Rhode Island. This decision rankled her father, who expressed distaste for her wealthy companions at the exclusive resort community. "I suppose young girls, and even young men, naturally, like a year or two of such a life as the 400 lead," he fretted to a friend, perhaps mindful of his own youthful snobbery in preferring to associate only with other gentlemen at Harvard. "But I do not think anyone can permanently lead his or her life amid such surroundings and with such objects, save at the cost of degeneration in character," he added, revealing how far his attitudes had changed. "I have not a doubt that they would mortally object to associating with me, but they could not possibly object 1/100th part as much as I should to associating with them. For mere enjoyment, I would a great deal rather hold my own in any congenial political society, even in Tammany." The rest of the children blissfully entertained themselves, their siblings, and their cousins with picnics, hikes, and sailboat rides. 15-year-old Ted Jr. and 13-year-old Kermit were happy to come home from boarding school at Groton. 11-year-old Ethel, who had boarded during the week at the National Cathedral School, happily assumed the role of little mother to her younger brothers Archie and Quentin. "She is a great comfort to them," Roosevelt contentedly remarked, "and they are great comforts to her." Nothing Edith accomplished as First Lady compared with the uncomplicated joy of long summer days with her husband at their family home. "Edith looks so young and pretty," Theodore beamed to Emily Carroll. Both relished this time alone, riding horses together through the woods, carrying lunches and books with them on picnic excursions, and rowing to the end of Lloyd's Neck, where they watched the white sails of coasters passing up and down the Sound. Their tranquil family escape came to an end with the season. As soon as Roosevelt returned to Washington, he was bombarded by delegations of party officials, senators, and congressmen. Only 13 months remained until the presidential election. "Whether I shall be re-elected, I have not the slightest idea," he admitted. "I know there is bitter opposition to me from many different sources. Whether I shall have enough support to overcome this opposition, I cannot tell." While large and enthusiastic crowds at every stop of his summer tour confirmed the president's unprecedented popularity, the American people did not control the nomination process in these days before the direct primary. Machine politicians and party bosses, the very men Roosevelt had opposed throughout his career, determined the candidates, and their selections were then endorsed by the very same financial interests he had antagonized during his 2 years as president. The public might applaud his antitrust policies and his intervention in the coal strike, but the big businessmen whose contributions sustained the Republican Party had become, in Roosevelt's words, determined foes. The whole country breathed freer and felt as if a nightmare had been lifted when I settled the anthracite coal strike, Roosevelt explained to British historian George Trevelyan. But while public memory of the crisis quickly dissipated, the interests to which I gave mortal offense will make their weight felt as of real moment. Roosevelt had not forgotten how the same web of political and financial interests had stymied his hope for a second gubernatorial term after he had defied the party with his franchise tax bill and his stubborn refusal to retain Boss Platt's corrupt friend Lou Payne as superintendent of insurance. Then Republican bosses had retaliated by attempting to bury him in the vice presidency. Now, he feared, they would deny him the nomination for president. Roosevelt understood perfectly that party leaders would vastly prefer Republican Party Chairman Mark Hanna, flesh of their flesh, bone of their bone, who had cemented the party's alliance with the corporations. Hanna had only to pass the word along, William Allen White observed, and within 10 days the politicians in the Republican Party would leave the president. While Roosevelt had successfully established some of his own men in various state positions, the national organization remained firmly in Hanna's control. The president's best hope lay in the fact that reform was in the air. All over the country, White observed, little Roosevelts were appearing in city halls, county courthouses, state houses, and occasionally were bobbing up in Congress. In Toledo, Republican reformer Samuel Jones had been elected mayor over the determined opposition of the Hanna machine. In Cleveland, Hanna's nemesis, Reform Democrat Tom Johnson, was serving a second term as mayor. A newly formed Municipal Voters League in Chicago, led by Republicans William Kent and George Cole, was engaged in a bitter fight against the entrenched corruption fostered by Charles T. Yerkes, the tycoon whose life Theodore Dreiser later fictionalized in his Trilogy of Desire. Republican Robert La Follette of Wisconsin had defied the machine to become governor by waging war on the railroads that ruled his state. These rousing stories were dramatically told in Lincoln Steffens' spectacular series on municipal and state corruption, Shame of the Cities, and Enemies of the Republic. Focusing national attention on these local battles, Steffens inspired reformers in other cities to address the corruption that plagued every level of government. His series played a significant role in toppling old bosses, bringing a new generation of Roosevelt-type reformers to positions of power in cities and states across the nation. As ever, the idea for the acclaimed series had originated with Sam McClure. Returning to the office in late 1901 after several months abroad, McClure encountered Steffens, then serving as managing editor, seated at his desk. "You may be an editor," McClure huffed dismissively, "but you don't know how to edit a magazine. You can't learn to edit a magazine here in this office. Get out of here. Travel. Go. Somewhere. Buy a railroad ticket. Get on a train. And there, where it lands you, there you will learn to edit a magazine." With McClure's support, Steffens embarked on an odyssey. For the better part of 3 years, he called on people in St. Louis, Minneapolis, Pittsburgh, Chicago, Philadelphia, New York, Cleveland, and Madison. "My business is to find subjects and writers, to educate myself in the way the world is wagging, so as to bring the magazine up to date," he explained to his father. "I feel ready to do something really fine." Following up on McClure's persistent interest in political corruption, he interviewed city editors, political bosses, crusading district attorneys, and reformist mayors. In each city, he uncovered an invisible web of power, linking political bosses to both the criminal world below and the business community above. His investigations convinced him that the misgovernment of American cities would furnish abundant material for a fascinating series featuring portraits of the bosses and the men who were fighting to expose their corruption. "If I should be entrusted with the work," he told Tarbell, "I think I could make my name." His conjecture proved accurate. The Shame of the Cities, the 6-part series that began in late 1902, made him an international celebrity. Everywhere he went during his first weeks of travel, the same questions stirred conversation. Everyone was speculating on the future of Joe Folk and the investigations he had undertaken in St. Louis. Curiosity aroused, Steffens took a train to St. Louis, and in a lobby corner of the Planters Hotel, met with the idealistic district attorney, who was just beginning to lay bare pervasive corruption within the democratically controlled city council and board of aldermen. Mistakenly assuming Folk would be safe, the Democratic bosses had nominated this smiling, even-tempered man of 33 for the district attorney post. The story Folk told fascinated Steffens from the start. An obscure notice in a local newspaper first caught the attorney's eye. A sizable quantity of cash had been deposited in a respected St. Louis banking house with the intention of bribing certain assemblymen to secure the passage of a street railway ordinance. Folk decided to follow up on the report, even though no names were mentioned. Suspecting that the legislation in question was a recent bill benefiting the Suburban Railway Company, he pieced their scheme together and issued dozens of subpoenas to assemblymen, councilmen, and the employees and management of Suburban Railway. Evaluating his list to determine who would most likely fold under pressure, he summoned the company president, Charles H. Turner, and the lobbyist rumored to have brokered the deal, Philip Stock. Turner and Stock were notified they had 3 days to cooperate. Facing indictment for bribery and prosecution to the full extent of the law, they both broke down and confessed. The ordinance in question, Turner told Folk, would have increased the value of his company by $3 million. To secure its passage, he had first approached Colonel Edward Butler, the longtime boss of St. Louis. When Butler demanded $145,000 to distribute among the assembly members, Turner hired Stock on his promise to get the bill passed for a mere $75,000. As soon as that amount was deposited into the bank, the legislation proceeded smoothly. A court decision soon overturned the franchise ordinance, however, and the Suburban Railway refused to turn over the money, claiming they had not secured the franchise. Legislators threatened to sue Turner and Stock, insisting that the money was theirs because they had done their part. During this contentious interchange, the newspaper leak occurred. The testimony of Turner and Stock led to numerous confessions, along with the convictions of 18 municipal assembly members. Folk's investigation eventually revealed that a precise schedule of bribery had been devised, specifying the price of obtaining wharf space, a side track, a switchway, a grain elevator, and so on. So long has this practice existed, Steffens was told, that members had come to regard the receipt of money for action on pending measures as a legitimate perquisite of a legislator. Indefatigable Folk would not be content until he felled the greatest oak in this forest of corruption. Colonel Butler, the man who had been saved from indictment in the Suburban scandal simply because he had demanded more money than the company would pay, had controlled nominations and elections in the city for years, becoming a multimillionaire through his schemes. It was generally understood that he owned assemblymen before they ever took the oath of office, Steffens wrote, giving him absolute control of legislation and the power to negotiate with businessmen seeking regulations, rulings, or ordinances. When Folk found two members of the Board of Health willing to testify that Butler had promised each of them $2,500 to sign off on a garbage contract, he put the swaggering boss on trial. Folk uncovered documents proving that once the contract was approved, Butler was due to receive over $200,000. In a dramatic closing statement before the jury, Folk argued that the state itself was on trial. "Missouri, Missouri, I am pleading for thee. Pleading for thee." Colonel Butler was convicted and sentenced to 3 years in prison. After hearing Folk's account, Steffens contacted McClure and Phillips to inform them that he had found an article for the magazine and the person to write it, a local reporter named Claude H. Wetmore. The subject thrilled McClure, but when the first draft arrived, he was displeased that names and places essential to authenticate and validate the story had been omitted. Under McClure's guidance, Steffens drafted a new version of the article so that every statement was a matter of record. Names of the legislators who fled the state were accompanied by details of their eventual arrests and confessions. A comical anecdote emerged of one House of Delegates member so frightened while under the inquisitorial crossfire that he was seized with a nervous chill. His false teeth fell to the floor, and the rattle so increased his alarm that he rushed from the room without stopping to pick up his teeth and boarded the next train. Satisfied with the revision, McClure proposed the evocative title, Tweed Days in St. Louis. The article, with both Wetmore and Steffens listed as co-authors, was a smashing success, prompting the publisher to build an entire series around municipal corruption that would accompany Tarbell's work on corporate corruption. A newspaper article condemning graft in Minneapolis drew McClure's attention, prompting him to focus Steffens' next project on the capital of Minnesota. There, testimony before the grand jury had revealed a system of police corruption similar to that Steffens had witnessed in New York during the days of the Lexo Commission. In return for police protection, a host of illegal establishments that included gambling operations, unlicensed saloons, and opium dens paid regular weekly fees. These spoils were divided between the Democratic mayor, his henchmen, and the police captains, all carefully recorded in ledgers each week. After befriending Hovey C. Clark, the courageous foreman of the grand jury, Steffens received permission to photograph pages from these ledgers. "Your article is certainly a corker," McClure enthused after reading the first draft. "We'll call it The Shame of Minneapolis, framed as a colossal battle between one crusading individual and the corrupt establishment." "You have made a marvelous success of your Minneapolis article," he assured Steffens. "We fellows are so busy pushing things through that we don't stop to tell each other how much we think of each other's work. But I take this moment to tell you." The piece, printed in the famous January issue, made headlines across the country. "Mr. Steffens' stirring story should be read everywhere," advised Outlook magazine, "for it strikes at the very heart of both the twin stupidities which dull the conscience of American municipalities, the optimism which says that all is so good nothing need be done, and the pessimism which says that all is so bad that nothing can be done." The Arizona Republic ardently proclaimed that by exposing corruption in St. Louis and Minneapolis, McClure's magazine was doing a public service, prodding people to conclude that similar corrupt networks were in scores of other cities not yet overtaken by a wave of reform. Steffens giddily recalled a train ride during which he overheard men in the washroom and dining car exclaiming over his story and his writing. The article was a surpassing success. The newsstand had exhausted the printed supply. Subscriptions were coming in, and the mail was bringing letters of praise. Citizens across the country invited him to their localities, promising scandals more sordid than those described in Minneapolis and St. Louis. He proudly told his father that as he entered a New York gentleman's club, members stood and applauded. With lavish promises, a London editor had tried to woo him from McClure's, while a cigar manufacturer even asked permission to christen a cigar after him, his portrait on the box lid. Flush with success, Steffens was anxious to scientifically test his dawning theory that corruption originated from the top, not the bottom, that it was not merely political, it was financial, commercial, social. He suspected that in every case, the web of corruption radiated out from the captains of industry, the big businessmen running gas and electric companies, street railways, and other public service corporations, who would do anything necessary to acquire lucrative franchises and privileges. Wary of philosophical generalizations, McClure feared that Steffens would invariably tint his observations or arrange facts to confirm his theory that businessmen were always to blame. He insisted that Steffens present facts, startling facts, that would involve the reader one step at a time in his detective work. While Steffens chafed to move on to Chicago or Philadelphia, McClure insisted he return to St. Louis to pursue the story in more detail. "The disagreement became acute," Steffens recalled. "It divided the office. At moments like this, Ida Tarbell was indispensable. Sensible, capable, and very affectionate. She knew each one of us and all our idiosyncrasies and troubles," Steffens wrote. She would sit the fractious parties down, smiling like a tall, good-looking young mother, to say, "Hush, children." A compromise was reached. Steffens would return to St. Louis, stick to facts, and only afterwards proceed to any city he desired. McClure's stipulation that Steffens must follow up in St. Louis proved most fortuitous. In the months since the first article had appeared, a series of events revealed the corruption in Missouri to run far deeper than either Folk or Steffens had suspected. When Butler's conviction reached the Missouri Supreme Court on appeal, the decision was reversed. All the alderman cases were overturned as well. Steffens discovered that over the years, Butler had directed the nominations not only of legislators, but also of justices on the very bench that heard the graft cases on appeal. Indeed, the presiding justice publicly called for Folk to leave Missouri, implying that his exposures were ruining the reputation of the state. More dispiriting still, when the next election arrived, the citizens of St. Louis blithely kept the Butler ring in power. All the felons were back in the assembly, undaunted by the initial round of convictions. Though McClure was again delighted with the substance of Steffens' article, he was less impressed with its structure. "Your narrative lacks force," he chided, suggesting that the tale should move forward with an inexorable momentum and culminate in the shocking circumstance that Butler and the convicted alderman remained in office, continuing to enact laws and reap profits. "I am telegraphing you to come east," McClure informed him, insisting, "You must be here with me when you are working out the article." The finished installment, which McClure entitled The Shamelessness of St. Louis, once again proved a stunning success. The pride and conscience of St. Louis had finally been kindled. On the city streets, 200,000 people sported Folk for Reform buttons. "Your article is bearing fruit," Folk told Steffens, observing that every number of your March edition has been sold here, and there is still a great demand for them. Finally, people rallied to support Folk's cause. Throughout the city, folk clubs were organizing. "The state is commencing to speak," Folk happily reported. "The permanent remedy is in the hands of the people, and someday they will apply it. I believe the public conscience is more alive to the situation today and the cause of civic righteousness brighter than for many years." "I must tell you how tremendously I am pleased with your achievements," McClure generously reassured Steffens. "I know of no young man who has such a splendid opportunity of work in front of him as you have." Furthermore, the publisher grandly instructed his reporter to inform Folk that he was the candidate of McClure's magazine at the present moment for president in 1908. McClure's closing remark revealed his cognizance of the massive influence his publication exerted on the American conscience. "I believe," he flatly told Steffens, "we can do more toward making a president of the United States than any other organ." After St. Louis, Steffens traveled to Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, Chicago, and New York, perfecting the interview technique that allowed him to elicit a great deal of information by sharing the little he already knew. He regaled Pittsburgh's boss with tales of how his counterparts in Minneapolis worked. He delighted reformers in Chicago with stories of how Folk had uncovered corruption in St. Louis. He spent hours just chewing the rag with the old boss of Philadelphia, fascinated by his rise to power. In conversations with a couple of wise guys in Minneapolis, he described the famous burglars and con men he had known in New York. "Thieves, politicians, businessmen, reformers, and our magazine readers," he commented, "all assumed that I had what I was trying to get, knowledge." His demeanor shrewdly implied that he already knew their secrets, he explained, so they might as well talk. Steffens' gift of drawing out his subjects soon became the stuff of legend. William Randolph Hearst considered Lincoln Steffens the best interviewer he ever met, and the New York World's Herbert Bayard Swope looked up to him as a demigod. As Steffens expanded the scope of his inquiry, he grew increasingly convinced that corruption in municipal politics was not a temporary evil engendered by the need for profitable new transportation and electrical facilities in explosively thriving young cities. Older cities, too, were rife with such dishonesty. nor could it be attributed to Republicans or Democrats, or to the presence of large immigrant populations under the sway of political bosses. Philadelphia, with the largest native population of any major city, suffered an epidemic of corruption. In every city, he now confidently argued, business interests were responsible. He had documented them buying boodlers in St. Louis, defending grafters in Minneapolis, originating corruption in Pittsburgh, sharing with bosses in Philadelphia, deploring reform in Chicago, and beating good government with corruption funds in New York. Corruption, it seemed, was the hallmark of the age, an age in which public spirit became private spirit, public enterprise became private greed. When the articles were collected into a book entitled The Shame of the Cities, Steffens was hailed as a moral prophet come to save the Republic from sin, and a worthy descendant of abolitionist agitator William Lloyd Garrison. Across the country, Lincoln Steffens was lionized as a new kind of journalist altogether. Instead of having his news and his editorial on separate pages, one critic noted, Steffens welds the two into one, so that the fact and the meaning and the portent of it strike you simultaneously. According to the Outlook, Steffens had correctly diagnosed the characteristic disease of the age, the itch to make a little more money by illegitimate means than can be made by legitimate industry. Rather than examine the abstract political and legal structures of city charters, William Allen White observed, Steffens had ventured into the wards and precincts of the towns and townships of this land in order to bring in specimens of actual government under actual conditions. These articles, another critic remarked, have done more to awaken the American conscience to civic duty than anything else written in many years. Immediately upon completing his series on the cities, Steffens embarked on an equally ambitious study of the states. Wherever he had sought to These articles, another critic remarked, have done more to awaken the American conscience to civic duty than anything else written in many years. Immediately upon completing his series on the cities, Steffens embarked on an equally ambitious study of the states. Wherever he had sought to track the political corruption of a city ring, he had found that the stream of pollution was part of a statewide watershed. While he could have chosen almost any state, Missouri seemed the logical starting point. As Joe Folk had learned when his cases were overturned, the system was indeed bigger than St. Louis. It was the system of Missouri. The state constitution prescribed a governor, a legislature, and a judiciary, he remarked, but this paper government has been superseded by an actual government, a network of legislators, bosses, and party leaders answering to the state's major industries. In addition, an investigation in Missouri would bolster Joe Folk's bid for governor on the Democratic ticket. He would be appealing his case to the people on a bold platform that corruption is treason, that the man who, elected to maintain the institutions of a government by the people, sells them out, is a traitor. Whether he be a constable, a legislator, a judge, or a boss, his act is not alone bribery, but treason. Returning a third time to St. Louis, Steffens again joined with Folk to reveal a sweeping bribery scheme that stretched from the president and agent of the Royal Baking Powder Company to the House and Senate combines to the lieutenant governor. Published under the title Enemies of the Republic, another one of McClure's brilliant reductions of a complex situation to slogan size, the article prompted a new round of vehement editorials across the country. Crediting Folk's work as district attorney, the New York Times called Steffens' piece a striking article that illuminated the situation with the utmost plainness, implicating prominent men in politics and in business, with specific instances of bribery, defining the purposes and stating the amounts, the givers, the takers. The Times concluded by calling on the public to condemn such pervasive dishonesty. When Americans really agree that corruption is treason, the editors argued, the traitors will be punished. Not legally alone, but as Benedict Arnold was, by the insufferable and blasting scorn of his fellow men. Folk's fight for the Democratic nomination tore the state wide open. But Stephan's articles had built the district attorney into such a heroic figure that the party did not dare reject him. "Your last article was magnificent and came in just in time to be of tremendous service," a grateful Folk told Stephan's. "You ought to be here and see how the people can run things when they take a mind to," he observed, having witnessed the effect of the article on the public. "My faith in the plain people has not been misplaced." They had achieved a stunning victory, Folk happily noted, when one thinks of the mighty power arrayed on the other side, the great corporations, the boodlers, the gamblers, a gigantic political machine, every professional politician in the state. "This bloodless political revolution," he continued, "could never have been accomplished without the indefatigable work of Stephan's and the support of McClure." After Missouri, Stephan's pursued investigations in five other states. In Wisconsin, he told the story of Fighting Bob La Follette. Soon after La Follette's election as governor, it became clear that his real adversaries were the corrupt leaders in his own Republican Party, who had fixed the legislature to kill his reform measures and discredit him with defeat. The failed legislative session taught La Follette that he had to outmaneuver the bosses, creating an organization of his own to beat the system and install trustworthy men in the legislature. This conflict was still raging when Stephan's arrived in Wisconsin. "To have you turn your searchlight on Wisconsin politics is better than anything our guardian angel could do for us, on Earth at least," La Follette's wife, Belle, confided to the reporter. Appearing a month prior to the election, Stephan's article applauded the young reformer's struggle against an entrenched system, asserting that his long, hard fight offered the people of Wisconsin a chance to make their government work for the common good rather than private interests. "La Follette's people think it has turned the scale in his favor," Stephan's informed his father. "But the other side is howling at it, and at me. It has sold out the magazine already." Governor La Follette not only won re-election, but finally met a friendly legislature, comprised of men who had gone through the fire with him and would readily enact his reform measures to regulate the railroads, institute the direct primary, address workmen's compensation, and establish tax reform. "No one will ever measure up the full value of your share in this immediate result," an exultant La Follette wrote Stephan's. During re-election campaigning, La Follette evidenced the impact of Stephan's article everywhere, even out on the farms, away back among the bluffs and coulees of the Mississippi, noting a distinct difference in his reception before and after its publication. "The article settled things," he said. "It was like the decision of a court of last resort." "The president has been very interested in your articles," Roosevelt's secretary informed Stephan's on August 24, 1903. "He wishes to inquire if you cannot come down here sometime to see him." A week later, Stephan's joined Roosevelt for lunch at Oyster Bay, renewing a friendship somewhat chilled by Stephan's frequent carping that the president compromised too readily with conservatives in his efforts to move legislation forward. Throughout his complicated relationship with Roosevelt, Stephan's worked to maintain distance as a political critic, keeping personal affection separate from professional judgment. For his part, Roosevelt managed to overcome occasional irritation with Stephan's in order to maintain a mutually advantageous alliance. During lunch, the two men spoke of Joseph Falk and his great fight against the Missouri bosses. Shortly thereafter, Stephan's followed up with a letter urging the president to meet with the young reformer. "He is a Democrat, but only as you are a Republican, and in motives and purposes, you and he would be in perfect accord," the journalist reassured him, adding, "You can get from him a great deal of information about essential facts, and all honestly given. Mr. Folk has gotten no little of his inspiration from you." Roosevelt readily agreed to send a letter of invitation to the young district attorney through Stephan's. "I wonder if you realize what a fundamental gratification such a letter will be to this man who has gone a long while along a lonely road with all big men against him," Stephan's appreciatively replied to the president. When Folk appeared at the White House, Stephan's related to his father, "He and the president, Democrat and Republican, became confidential at sight. and the president thanked me for bringing Folk to his notice. Writing to a Missouri Republican, Roosevelt later proclaimed that though Folk headed the Democratic ticket, his nomination represented a complete destroying of the old corrupt machine and the success of the movement.